It is not your priority to give up your position of authority so another legislator can get a better seat at the finance table.
Ketchikan constituents are not happy with their representatives' recent actions. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 15th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the go-ahead for gas exploration near Healy doesn't sit well with locals.
We hear the concerns and we hope we can learn from the mistakes of other places and we won't have those kind of problems here.
Those stories and the U.S. Senate vote count update tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
From Kodiak to Kosigluk to Kotzebue, Alaska is firing up with renewable power. Come celebrate at Renewable Energy Alaska Project's 6th anniversary party and fundraiser, 6 to 8 p.m. November 19th at the Snow City Cafe. Enjoy music, drinks, appetizers, and 6 years of working to energize Alaska with clean, local, sustainable power. More information online at realaska.org or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
As vote counting ended today, Lisa Murkowski is a little more than 1,000 votes ahead in her write-in campaign to keep her seat in the U.S. Senate. That total, 91,517 votes, includes ballots that have been credited to her but challenged by observers for Republican nominee Joe Miller. Without those challenged ballots, Murkowski still falls short of Miller as the division heads into its final days of counting with about 10,000 more ballots remaining. Murkowski is still getting 98% of the write-ins as they are counted. For the past 6 days, Lisa Murkowski has been getting 90% of those write-in votes unchallenged by Miller observers. If the trend continues, Murkowski will be solidly on top with tomorrow's totals. But the number and status of those challenged ballots is at the center of the issue, and either side is ready to claim victory or admit defeat, both saying they'll wait for the final numbers to come in. Miller spokesman Randy DeSoto says he still feels good about the results. He's looking at Murkowski's total votes without those that have been challenged by Miller observers.
We're still at a place where Senator Murkowski's overall numbers haven't crossed the threshold of our numbers that are not contested. So we're thinking when this is all over, it'll likely be that the difference between Joe's numbers and Senator Murkowski's will fall within the range of the contested ballots.
Murkowski's campaign staff is not giving the challenged ballots any serious consideration, however. Campaign manager Kevin Sweeney says the Division of Elections has determined that those challenged ballots should belong to Murkowski, and he's counting them too.
What we've been seeing is consistently 98% of those votes, according to the Division of Elections, are being credited to Lisa Murkowski. So when you take tonight's final count, you multiply it by 0.98, you get a pretty good idea of what the final picture is going to be. Lisa Murkowski will be beating Joe Miller by thousands of votes.
When the votes are all counted, DeSoto says a narrow vote margin will result in Miller asking the courts to make the determination. Sweeney says Murkowski's legal team is confident that Miller will have no success there.
The challenges right now are not simply misspellings, like they say. They say that they've been following the statute as they read it, that we're only looking at the misspellings. Well, that is not true. They've changed their standard throughout. They could change their standard tomorrow, and they could challenge every single ballot, and somehow they could say that that brings it all into question.
The counting will resume tomorrow at midday. The election is on track to be certified by November 29th, at which point any further legal action could begin. Senator Lisa Murkowski is currently back in Washington, D.C., and says she's confident she'll win her re-election bid, but is content to wait until there's a clear margin before she declares victory. She says some of her Senate colleagues in Washington, both members of her own Republican Party and Democrats, like Florida's Ben Nelson, are giving her positive responses.
I just saw Senator Nelson, who's a couple doors down here. He dropped by to say congratulations and looking forward to working with me. And I had to tell him, well, you know, not congratulations yet. We're still finishing things up. But I have received a lot of telephone calls from friends that are pleased that things are looking as good as they are in Alaska.
Even though the election was nearly 2 weeks ago, Murkowski is still wearing a blue rubber bracelet used by her campaign to teach voters how to spell her name.
I'm a little superstitious. I'm not taking it off until victory is truly in hand. So I'm still wearing it.
If Murkowski does pull off the write-in win, she'll be the first successful Senate write-in since the 1950s. Representative Kyle Johansson will meet tonight with District 1 Republicans following his decision to walk out on the state House Majority Caucus and give up his position as House Majority Leader. District 1 Republicans had requested the meeting. They originally announced the meeting would be public, but later stated Johansson would only agree to a private meeting. The Ketchikan Republican has increasingly come under fire in his hometown. The Ketchikan Daily News this past weekend ran an editorial calling on Johansson to resign. KRBD's Deanna Garrison has the story.
News that Johansson had given up his leadership role and walked out of the majority caucus has not set well with many of his constituents in District 1. District 1 Republican Chair Dick Coos says a local party asked for a meeting with Johansson to discuss his recent actions.
There just needs to be some one-on-one reassurance that we are going to be able to accomplish what we needed to accomplish up there.
Coos says many District 1 Republicans are upset, and some are suggesting that Johansson should be asked to tender his resignation.
They're pretty serious. People are not real happy at this point.
The Ketchikan Daily News came out with an editorial calling on Johansson to resign. The editorial, entitled Time to Go, says Johansson and Millett are now the two most powerless legislators in the House. Republican Jackie Durrett says she has spoken with a number of past supporters who say they plan to demand that Johansson return previous campaign contributions. She says she doesn't buy Johansson's stated reason for leaving the majority caucus.
2 and 2 still makes 4. His explanation to me doesn't make 4.
Johansson did not respond to an interview request for this story. However, in an interview with the Ketchikan Daily News, Johansson said he left the caucus because he was particularly concerned with the makeup of the House Finance Committee. He says members seated on that committee would neither be business-friendly nor support resource development. Johansson says he left the caucus after the majority decided to give Dillingham Democrat Bryce Edgman a seat on the Finance Committee. He told the newspaper that he is concerned the incoming Finance Committee members support Coastal Zone Management Program legislation. Edgman sponsored a Coastal Zone Management Bill last legislative session. Johansson co-sponsored that legislation in March. Edgman is one of 4 Democrats to caucus with the majority. He had caucused with the majority while Johansson was majority leader. In a written statement following the caucus meeting, House Speaker Mike Chenault said neither Millett nor Johansson had a problem with the majority's decision to caucus with rural Democrats in past legislative sessions. City of Ketchikan Mayor Lou Williams III says he isn't quite sure why Johansson decided to quit the majority.
He has a relationship with the other Anchorage representative, and maybe that got in the way of things. I don't know. I'm just disappointed. I just felt like District 1 wasn't on top of his mind when he made his decision to walk out on the caucus.
Williams says he and other local officials are convinced that Johansson's recent decisions will make it more difficult for the city to get funding for local projects from the state.
I'm definitely surprised. I've talked to a lot of people in town that are really surprised and upset.
Ketchikan Gateway Borough Mayor Dave Kiefer says he was shocked to find out that Johansson had given up his leadership position.
As House Majority Leader, he was certainly able to control legislation and be in a position to really, really benefit the citizens of District 1, which is his mission up there. Then when I heard he wasn't even in the majority at all, I was even more shocked because that's really stepping away from the plate, so to speak, to the point that, you know, it's really hard to get much of anything done. Then when I heard he wasn't even in either that or the minority caucus, at that point you're starting to think, okay, what's going on?
Kiefer says he is particularly concerned that Johansson would sacrifice his leadership position for a legislator from another district.
Your job is to go up there and represent your district. And in no way, when he reportedly made that offer, could I see him remotely be helping this district. You are sent to Juneau, whoever you are, to represent District 1. That is your first priority. It is not your priority to give up your position of authority so another legislator can get a better seat at the finance table.
District A Senator Bert Stedman says he hopes Johansson will continue serving the district and will rejoin the majority.
Well, I've enjoyed and worked well with Rep. Johansson since he's, been representing the district in Juneau, and look forward in the future to continuing that close relationship.
That was Deanna Garrison from KRBD in Ketchikan. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, interior fiddle players show off their skills.
It is the Athabascan Grand Ole Opry right here in Fairbanks.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Usabelli Coal has been given the okay to explore for natural gas in the Healy area. The state has announced it will not reconsider its earlier decision to grant the company a license to look for gas on more than 200,000 acres of land east and west of the park's highway near Denali National Park. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the move has some locals upset.
Healy area residents have been weighing the potential of finding a cleaner burning energy source with the impacts of development since Usabelli first applied for a gas exploration license back in 2004. After many delays, the Department of Natural Resources issued a best interest finding in support of the license this summer, but two local organizations and several individuals requested reconsideration. This week, the DNR rejected the requests and gave Usabelli the license. The decision isn't sitting well with some, like Healy resident Barbara Breeze, who says gas development is a bad fit for the area.
It's just laying the groundwork for to turn Healy, my quiet residential area, into industrial wasteland right next to the national park.
Breeze and others are concerned about the license's inclusion of residential and recreational areas and what they consider inadequate environmental protection measures. The license allows for exploration for shallow coal bed methane or deep conventional gas, and since most Alaska landowners do not have subsurface rights, drilling can happen on their property. Healy resident Jared Zimmerman with the Pangini Creek Homeowners Association says gas development will impinge on the Stampede Road subdivision north of the park.
We live out on, where there's quite a bit of open tundra. So having, oil wells, within sight, and there's noise issues, water quality issues. A lot of people have wells.
Another Healy resident, Susan Braun, says gas drilling has a bad track record, especially when it comes to groundwater.
Garfield County, Colorado, released a study last December that showed that gas had migrated from the drilling process into people's drinking water.
Braun acknowledges that Healy is only at the exploration threshold, but is concerned about worst-case scenarios and falling private property values. There are some protections in state law. Regulations provide setbacks for drilling on or near private property and regulate how drilling mud and water are handled. State Oil and Gas Director Kevin Banks says development will likely take place on a fraction of the 208,000 acres licensed.
There will probably be nothing more than a small wellhead and perhaps a gravel pad of some small size and a road.
Banks says residents should not make comparisons with what's happened with gas in the lower 48, where private landowners lease property to oil companies. He says state control of subsurface in Alaska means responsibility for development and environmental protection, adding that the state has everyone's best interests in mind.
If gas were found here, it could perhaps either power a power plant or be pumped into some kind of gas line to Fairbanks.
Banks says most state gas exploration licenses don't result in any actual work. It doesn't appear that anything will happen quickly in the Healy area. Usabelli Vice President of New Development Steve Denton says the company has been focused on another local gas exploration project at nearby Nenana, and that the Healy project has been backburnered.
So basically the first thing we need to do is step back and
review the you know, what our plans might actually be. We don't have any plans in place at this point.
State approvals and permits are required for each step along the way of gas development, including the exploration plan. And Denton says the company is listening.
We hear the concerns, and we hope we can learn from the mistakes of other places, and we won't have those kind of problems here.
The Healy area residents opposed to gas development say they'll participate in the review process of each step, but are not ruling out a legal appeal of the exploration license. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The U.S. Congress returned to work today in Washington, D.C. for the lame duck session. That's the time between Election Day and when the new batch of House and Senate members are sworn in January. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
This lame duck is the twilight of Democratic power in the House, where Nancy Pelosi will wield the gavel as Speaker for a final few weeks. After the sweeping victory by Republicans in House districts all over the country, they'll be in control of that body come January. Congressman Don Young is looking forward to that and expects to get a subcommittee chairmanship. He says top on the agenda now during the lame duck is whether to extend the Bush-era tax cuts. Republicans want them all extended, but some Democrats say keep them only for middle-class Americans, not the high-wage earners.
If I had a crystal ball, I think we probably will address the tax extenders. I don't know whether they would become law. They'll probably negotiate a one-year extension for everybody, a five-year extension for 250,000 and down.
Also set to expire, long-term extended jobless benefits and breaks to the estate tax. And the budget is on the docket. Congress hasn't passed any of the major spending bills for the new fiscal year. Young says it's most likely they'll just pass another temporary resolution.
I don't think much will happen. It would probably pass a continuing resolution, which has to happen if the government keeps running. There may be some opposition to that, too.
Alaska Senator Mark Begich announced on Monday that he's got a new job, his first in a leadership post, as chairman of the Senate Democratic Steering and Outreach Committee. It works to build communication with groups outside Congress and is mostly made up of the chairs of major Senate committees, giving Begich FaceTime with some of the caucus's power players. Some members of Begich's party want to see legislation dealt with before everything changes in January. Even though Democrats will keep control of the Senate, it'll be a slimmer margin.
There's a lot of issues still pending in the lame duck session, such as Paycheck Fairness Act, FDA, food safety, issues around natural gas and what we do about electric vehicles and converting them. Those are kind of small issues, but the reality is I think lame duck is going to be around these bigger issues.
Begich says those bigger issues are reforming taxes and education and fixing the way Congress does business. As to whether any of that will actually be tackled now is another thing. The Senate is Capitol Hill's cooling chamber, so legislation may fall at its doorstep with a quiet thud. Senator Lisa Murkowski also says she'd like to see tax issues tackled, and she doesn't want to see Democrats push through last-minute bills.
I think we need to look carefully and critically at what will be put before the Senate. This should not be viewed as an opportunity for the Democrats to pass things that they couldn't get passed before, just because it's like, okay, this will be the last opportunity with our numbers at this level. If it's not good legislation before and we weren't able to get it passed, then it probably isn't good legislation now.
Murkowski points to a pending bill on natural gas vehicles as not a top priority. She says with national unemployment at more than 9%, now's not the right time.
I think a lot of people are going to look at that and say, so wait a minute, what does that have to do with what's going on with a struggling economy? Is this really what you're going to be debating right now, is how we advance natural gas-powered vehicles? So I think it's important that we look critically at the initiatives that will move forward.
On Tuesday, Senate Republicans will hold their organizational meeting behind closed doors, but Murkowski will not participate.
Since the election is not yet certified in Alaska and since the votes are still being counted as we speak, it's not anticipated that I will be seated at the meeting tomorrow, which is unfortunate because there will be a vote on the future of earmarks and whether or not the Senate Republicans move to ban those I think that that would be a mistake for us as a conference to do that.
The leader of Republican Senators Mitch McConnell came out Monday against earmarks, a shift in policy for him. Republicans will also vote Tuesday on their leadership team. Murkowski was a member of that top group, but stepped down after pressure from McConnell when she launched her write-in bid. Her name will not be floated as part of the leadership team on Tuesday. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The prosecutors who bungled the case against the late Senator Ted Stevens will not face criminal contempt charges, according to NPR. After the former Alaska senator was convicted 2 years ago for lying on financial disclosure forms, the conviction and case were thrown out by Judge Emmett Sullivan. He was urged to do so by U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, who said the case was conducted improperly. Judge Sullivan said Justice Department lawyers withheld important information and evidence from Stevens and his attorneys, which hurt Stevens' defense. The judge named a special investigator last year, Henry Schulke, to launch an investigation into the prosecution team. Now, NPR is reporting that sources familiar with the case say the prosecutors won't face criminal charges. Schulke and the Justice Department would not comment to APRN today. Schulke has been collecting evidence and interviews for more than a year and is expected to turn over a written report to Judge Sullivan.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at GrantStation.com. Elks National Foundation, in conjunction with the Alaska State Elks Association and local lodges, is offering the Most Valuable Student MVS Scholarship for high school seniors. These scholarships are awarded to graduating high school seniors through a local, state, and national competition and are based on scholarship, leadership, and financial need. Information and applications available at elks.org/ENF. Application deadline is December 1st, 2010. This message sponsored by the Alaska Elks Association.
A young man who stole $7 and beer from a homeless man before kicking and stomping him to death in a city park has been sentenced to 70 years in prison. On Friday, 19-year-old Mark Stephen Ewing was convicted of second-degree murder in the death of 37-year-old James Lockery III. Lockery, an unemployed drywaller, was attacked on July 12, 2009, while he was asleep in the park in Anchorage. Superior Court Judge Michael Spann described the crime as particularly depraved and senseless. He sentenced Ewing to 70 years in prison with 20 years suspended, meaning that Ewing will spend about 50 years in prison. One of the largest Athabascan gatherings in the world took place in Fairbanks over the weekend, as it does every year. It's not a conference or a shareholder meeting. It's a fiddle festival. For the 28th consecutive year, people have come from across the interior and Canada to sing, dance, and play the fiddle. From Fairbanks, Emily Schwing has more.
When you walk into the David Salmon Tribal Hall in downtown Fairbanks this time of year, your nose twitches with the smell of strong coffee, and your ears perk up at the sound of the fiddle. Musicians are warming up for their performances in the big kitchen at the back of the hall. This is where you can find elders like Patty Nolner, Roy Folger, and Josh Olin. They've all been coming to the Athabascan Fiddle Festival since it began in 1982.
We love fiddle music, and it brings people together and see old friends that we've never seen for a year or two, you know, and we meet some new ones, and we just enjoy the music.
I know, well, the music is good for everybody, you know. I get to see a lot of friends and make new friends. And it's just a good time to be getting together.
And we see all our friends from different villages. We have friends from Aleutian. We have friends from the Panhandle, up way up far as Barrow and over Kotzebue. And the whole interior get together, and it's just a big event, and it got so big that there's no way you can stop it.
Fiddling came to Alaska over 100 years ago when miners and trappers came north, and the music stayed long after.
Gerald Pilot says he knows where everyone is from based on the music they come to play at the festival.
You have downriver, which is traditional country. I mean, the Hank Williams, Jimmy Rogers, the old-time country. You have the Guichen people who are more influenced by the French Canadian, which is the jigs and the reels and the faster beats. And then you have other areas further downriver, and then Otna country, where they have a blend of different types of music.
Ann Fears is the coordinator for the Athabaskan Fiddlers Association. Like most of the older musicians, Fears learned to play the guitar and the fiddle by ear and sight.
My mother's home is Nalato, and when I was small, I used to notice that there was a lot of musicians in every other household that would play guitar or fiddle. And I saw some women for the first time in my life playing, and it really touched me. And then my grandpa also played the fiddle and guitar, so I learned by watching and listening, and I was heavily influenced by some of the players.
Fears says the largest concern for the Fiddlers Association is not only the loss of their elders and the lack of women who play, but also disinterest in music in younger generations.
And we want the youngers to come on up on stage, meet our old-timers, and just meld their music in with the old-time style and bring it to what it is today. Join their new style and the old style together. If we can see that happening, that would make us feel like that we're accomplishing our goal of keeping the Fiddling Festival alive.
And this year, a number of younger musicians were joined by students from Minto and the F.E. Cochran School in Fairbanks. And Fears expects the festival might outgrow capacity at the Tribal Hall in coming years.
We are so rich when we all come together like this, because there's the whole culture of this fiddling festival is unique like no other music event. It is the Athabaskan Grand Ole Opry right here in Fairbanks.
In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Are home heating costs more than you can manage? If you're living on a fixed income or reduced income, the Heating Assistance Program may be able to help. To obtain more information or an application form, visit the Heating Assistance Program website at heatinghelp.alaska.gov or call 1-800-470-3058. Sometimes a little help makes all the difference. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. From Kodiak to Kosigluk to Kotzebue, Alaska is firing up with renewable power. Come celebrate at Renewable Energy Alaska Project's 6th anniversary party and fundraiser, 6 to 8 p.m. November 19th at the Snow City Cafe. Enjoy music, drinks, appetizers, and 6 years of working to energize Alaska with clean, local, sustainable power. More information online at realaska.org or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.